host Dixie Cochran, and with me are Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
And Eddie Webb. I almost said Eddie Fate because I'm so used to looking at that name.
And that is how he's known on all social media. Look, we've already got to the end of the podcast. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time.
Bye, we're done.
Yeah, that was an excellent interview with Steffi, I thought.
Yeah.
She was very...
She's so very quiet.
Reached the point.
Anyway, this week we are interviewing Steffi Devan, who is a developer on Promethean. She's worked on Daemon. She's worked on a million things. She also works for a publishing company in her native Netherlands. So we'll be talking to her about all of that. Do either of you have any questions for her we should be looking for?
I mean, I'm mostly just curious what it's like working from the Netherlands with largely American clients. I know I had some challenges when I lived in Ireland, so I'm curious what her perspective is on that as well.
I intend to bombard Steffi with questions about Promethean, because Promethean is one of my favourite Chronicles of Darkness lines, and it's one that not everyone gets. It certainly has some barriers to entry, or at least used to for first edition, most of which have been knocked down for second. So
right.
I will be inquisitorial when it comes to Promethean the Created.
Oh yeah, I'm a big fan of that line too, so I'm really excited to hear kind of her perspective on it. As always, we're kicking one of us out for the interview. So this week it's
Bye-bye,
Eddie.
Guys.
We're gonna make him go away.
Be gone.
And I've actually never spoken to Steffi before, so this will be fun. I've emailed with her several times since that's one of the lines that I work on, but I've never actually spoken to her, so it'll be exciting.
Okay, let's get to it.
All right. And I am here with Matthew Dawkins. And Steffi Devan, or Devan.
Hey.
I've actually never asked you how you say your last name.
Van.
Van. Okay, so it is Steffi Devan. All right. She is one of our developers on Promethean. She's also written for just about every game line that we have.
Very prolific.
Yeah. Steffi likes working, from what I can tell. She's also worked on Chill, I do believe, and 7th Sea, just all over the industry. She also is part of, I think, her own publishing company. She's one of the developers at Angry Hamster Publishing.
Yeah,
with a couple of other ladies.
Liz Chayapredictkul's company, and she invited me to join her. So
that's wonderful.
I did.
And through that, you did Witch and Familiars of Terra, correct?
Yeah, and we're now doing Afterlife and lots of other projects.
That's awesome. So how did you get involved with the RPG industry in general? Is it from being a gamer? Is it from being a writer? Where did this kind of start for you?
Both. I am a very avid RPG gamer, and I write, and I used to write for a web game where you raise pets. You have a pet and you raise it and you go on adventures, like Neopets, but smaller. And so I wrote for that, and I loved RPGs, and then Onyx Path had an all-call where you could send in an application, and I did, and they hired me for Promethean, the second edition book. And
wonderful.
And then I basically emailed every developer that I was in contact with through that book and asked them if they had any books that I could be on.
Now, I know that tactic well, and you ended up on the book with me, didn't you, V20 True Black Hand?
Yes, I did.
Mm. Memories of long ago. We were so young back then, Steffi, so young.
Very young, very inexperienced and naive. And
That's how you get the work, though. I mean, you get on a book, you do a good job, you ask people for more work. I know you've been looking for more things to develop recently. So.
Yeah, definitely.
So of the projects you worked on, have you noticed any... like major differences between companies that you're interested in talking about? Or is there a different style that different people, you know, different developers bring to the table versus how you develop?
Yeah, it's less companies. Well, companies in the sense that that they use, somebody might use Slack or the other one uses email or the other one uses Google Groups. But mm-hmm. mostly the differences are per developer and not exactly per company. Some people are very hands-off. And others are much more involved and nitty-gritty, and Onyx Path actually has a lot of room for people, for writers to contribute ideas and pitch in and brainstorm and, you know, fight the developers, not fight them, but I mean, go like, Matthew, I think we should do it this way. And then Matthew says, yeah, that's interesting. Let's try that. Or he might say, no, that's a dumb idea. Let's not. But he says it in a nice way.
Yeah, that's because I'm British. Okay, well, cross-examination time then, Steffi. So what kind of development method do I follow? And is it, does it appeal to you as a writer? And don't worry, there's no wrong answer here, except you might not get hired again.
Ah, nice. No pressure. I think I was on your first book, wasn't it? The Beckett's Jihad Diary. Was that your first development job?
Oh, that's a good question. Was it my first development job? I think it may have been, you know, because I was co-developing that with Neil.
Mm-hmm.
But I came into that around as a developer at about Redline stage. I wasn't involved.
Yeah, because you were part of the writers.
Hmm.
And then you came in. I find your style to be pleasant, actually. It's you're fairly hands offish, but that might be because you and I have been on a ton of projects together, so you might do more hand holding for new authors. But whenever I have a question, you respond very quickly, which is nice because then I can get on with my end of the work.
I know this interview isn't supposed to be a personal development plan review of Matthew Dawkins, but now I know something about my development process. I've never actually asked for feedback from people. That's probably a bit silly. But anyway, allow me to butt out and allow the questions to continue.
Yeah.
You're fine. It's a joint interview, after all. You're more than welcome to ask questions. Yeah, so you actually live in the Netherlands.
I do.
Which, what's it like being so far removed from the bulk of the process? Since, okay, I mean, most of us are American, obviously. Mm-hmm. Matthew's not.
Oh, dear.
But most of us are in the US and Canada.
I'm going to try to frame this in a non-political way.
Oh, well, yeah, no, I don't want to get into American politics right now.
So there is definitely times when everybody's going to Gen Con and things like that I'm really bummed that I'm not going, because the flight is terribly expensive in addition to everything else. So from the sense of I would love to meet all of you in person and, you know, do hair and makeup and play in a game together. Yeah, I miss that. I miss, because we're all, full disclosure, we're all Facebook friends. So
right.
I see people tagging each other in pictures, and I'm not jealous because they're all my friends too, and I'm not really the type to be jealous of my friends, but there is this sense of, oh, that looks like so much fun. I wish it was there.
Yeah.
But then there are other things which don't have to do with the industry, but just with the world at large, that makes me very happy to be in Europe and the Netherlands.
Very, very apolitical of you, but yes, I understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt the same way when UK Games Expo was going on. I was like, man, I wish I was there hanging out with Steffi and Matthew and everybody that I never get to see.
I was like, why didn't they fly over any of the American people? Oh yeah, because that would be really expensive, and they flew over the Dutch person. Okay.
But
it was a lot of fun to meet Matthew and Matt in person.
Yeah.
So.
It will be interesting because we intend to go to the UK Games Expo again next year in some form or other. And at time of recording, UK Games Expo was about 2 weeks ago. And this was the first time I got to meet Steffi. And we were all running games there for Onyx Path Publishing and doing a bit of meeting and greeting, hobnobbing with potential customers and the like. And because it's the UK's largest role-playing gaming convention in general, it will be interesting to see what presence we have there in the future, whether we send more of the Americans over or whether we recruit more of the European contingent, because we've got lots of freelance writers who are European.
Yeah, well, the Dutch girl still wants to go, even if you're flying over the Americans, especially if you're flying over the Americans.
I mean, I tried to hide away in someone's suitcase for this last one because I have not been to England in, God, two decades. And I love it. And I was kind of like, I want to go. I can go. I'm not doing anything. But as you said, overseas flights are prohibitively expensive. So for the company to fly over, even if it was just me, Eddie, and Matt, that's still thousands of dollars. So, yeah. Hopefully. We'll see.
Yeah. But, and we actually, yes. We found out that my entire trip from door to the expo was actually shorter than Matthew's trip. And I had to fly
there. Oh, really?
Yeah.
That I did not realize that, Matthew. But at least you didn't, you know, have all the headaches you had traveling to Gen Con last year.
Okay, so I don't think I told Steffi this. The trip on the way back was even worse because I fell asleep on the train. The big problem with expos, Gen Con, you know, all the convention scenes is you're always working way into the night and socializing, generally having a nice time. And that means on the day after, you tend to crash a little on the way back. And I fell asleep on my train, and I ended up in a place called Taunton, which is in the southwest of England. I don't live in the southwest of England. It took me longer to get home on the Monday I came back from the UK Games Expo than it takes for me to fly to the United States of America.
Yeah, but
oh no!
But that might also have to do with the British rail system.
Yeah, well,
which did not leave me terribly impressed. We've got we in the Netherlands we complain about a lot about our rail system. Because they are very, very safe. And that means the moment there are leaves or snow on the tracks, they clear them before the trains start going again, or they put out special trains that clear them, which means that everything is then delayed. So, of course, we complain about that because, you know, leaves and snow happen all over the world and people manage to run their trains. It's just that the Dutch rail company is very, very safe. But
it's a bad thing overall.
No, it's a good thing. And they're pretty quick and cheap, I discovered while I was in England. So
you found
newfound appreciation for
it. I know this is a very odd tangent to have gone on to in a role-playing game podcast, but on the subject of rail, you found the British railway service reasonably priced.
I did. No, I thought it was expensive.
Oh, sorry, I misunderstood.
No. I thought it was expensive.
Yes, yeah. It is. It is ridiculously, prohibitively expensive. If you land in London and need to travel anywhere by rail, it will cost you more to catch a train somewhere than it does to catch the plane to the UK, and that isn't an exaggeration. But I don't drive, so I am restricted by that. But anyway, yeah. Let's get on to things.
So the conclusion is that you should all come to Amsterdam, and we will just rail across the country and play games on the train.
Well, there's lots of gaming conventions in the Netherlands.
Sounds amazing.
Gaming convention, yeah. Well, they're kind of tiny compared to the UK Game Expo.
Yeah, well, you know, from tiny acorns.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, most conventions start kind of small. I think the exceptions are ones that are run by, like, Reed Pop, who does Comic-Con, and PAX, of course. If they open a new convention, it's guaranteed to have 50,000 people show up. But past that, most conventions start smaller. But I would love to go to a European convention at some point, in general. That said, I'm going to, you know, rail this back onto some of the games that you've worked on.
Geez.
So you are our Promethean developer, as of right now. What about that line do you like particularly? Because I can tell when I read your work that you have a very deep kind of passion for that one.
Yeah, I love Promethean because it's a very humanist game. It's so Prometheans are constructions. They're created from usually corpses of people, but sometimes from things and machinery, and they have a spark of divine fire in them, which doesn't work well with anything in this world. They burn too brightly, and the world doesn't like that, so it rejects them on a very, very basic level. It hurts to be Promethean. And so the goal of the game is to go on a pilgrimage and to become human. That's it. You don't want to be a better monster or more powerful monster or defeat your enemies. You want to be human. And while every storyteller can handle that as they want, the assumption is a baseline mortal, no powers. And I love that because to me, being a human who's happy in their own skin is just about the best thing you could possibly be. And one of the hardest things you could ever be.
Yeah, I mean, that's what most people are trying to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Like actual mortals in the real world.
Yeah, exactly. And Promethean is about everything people do. There's a lot of people do ugly things, people do beautiful things. I happen to believe, it's been tested lately, but I believe that eventually we do trend towards the light and towards goodness and kindness. And all of that I can put into Promethean. There's this sense of hope that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, which is, as a person who occasionally finds herself in that tunnel, the fact that there's a light, and you know that because the divine principle is there, it's at your side, and it's telling you, there's a light, keep going. This tunnel right. has an end, and that is so powerful to me.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned that in previous podcasts, that I thought Promethean was a very, like, hopeful game. It is it's one of my favorite games that I've never gotten to play, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a very difficult game to run.
Yeah, there are quite a few that I haven't gotten to play, but I've of course, you know, yeah. read through quite a few things about Promethean, whether it was in Dark Eras or whether it's the Night Horrors book I'm working on. It's a gorgeous game. It's critically underrated.
Mm-hmm. And it's being a Promethean sucks really badly. But yeah, I know a lot of people who struggle, and I know that they would give anything to have that certainty of keep going, there's an end to this tunnel. So yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean you can equate it to people that struggle with mental illness, people that struggle with other chronic illnesses, or just, you know, people that are going through a rough time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we struggle with a lot of things, all of us.
It's a very right, interesting exactly. game in the sense that way back when I first spoke to Richard Dansky about Wraith the Oblivion, he described Wraith, which is often seen as the most unplayable or hard to play World of Darkness game, as the most hopeful mm-hmm. one as well. Out of all of the World of Darkness games, Wraith he considers as the most hopeful one, because you have something to aim for. You are trying to transcend or move on or find some satisfaction based on what was holding you back. And Promethean is almost the other side of that coin, because it's still hopeful, but you're not trying to move on to, I guess, whatever transcendental fate awaits you. You are trying to become what everyone else is. You're trying to become mortal. And there's something, it's obviously it's a different kind of horror. It's not blood and guts and sex and violence. It's very much a horror of tragedy and solitude. But I've got a question for you, Steffi. And this is a question mm-hmm. that we often see on the forums. You will often see people ask this on places like RPGNet, and it's specifically regarding Promethean. People will frame Promethean as a game that is ideally suited to the solo chronicle, where you've got one storyteller, one player. But in second edition, we made great efforts to make it a game where you can have multiple Prometheans in your throng. And if you can, I would like for you to explain how that works. Why would Prometheans stick together? What kind of construct does the storyteller need to put in place for that to work and not feel contrived?
Well, the thing is that Prometheans, because they're all in this hard place, they stick together out of a pretty fairly altruistic sense of, if we can help one of us, if one of us reaches New Dawn, then we now all know it can be done. So there is a sense of altruism there. And there's also a very practical sense that people don't like being around Prometheans. So if you want to stick with somebody for a longer time and have them know you and you know them and build some sort of relationship, another Promethean is your only bet. So those are the in-game reasons why they stick together. There's both a sense of altruism and a sense of, if not these people, then nobody. And it works out of game because you can push their milestones together. every player hands in a background and potential, and you work out potential milestones. They hand them in, and you come up with new ones as a storyteller. And you can mesh them together. Like, you can have two, three, or more people reach a milestone in the same event. It takes a bit of planning and sometimes a bit of retconning that you go like, oh, yeah, that was your milestone too. I originally planned something else, but that works.
But that can work.
But it's absolutely possible.
But I was going to say that.
Yeah, that's definitely something that if we ever do a guide to the pilgrimage, which would be like a combined storyteller and player guide, if we ever do that, which would be awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely in for it. That would be one of the things to discuss, like, how do you run such an extremely personal game with personal milestones for a group more than one? And part of it is planning really well, and the other part is winging it and retconning things.
It's funny because we had a meeting earlier today, Dixie, myself, and some of the other in-house people at Onyx Path, and we were talking about books of that nature, just hypothetically, you know, the kind of thing that introduces readers to the core concepts of games, just to, I guess, give them that hook to bring them in. And I can very well see something like that for Promethean being popular and really helping people understand the game. Because there is definitely a higher barrier to understanding Promethean than some of the more immediately accessible games.
Yeah, and it takes a bit more planning. There's a lot of games that I've run and that I will run on the fly. Like, everybody hands in a character sheet and I'll make something up. But with Promethean, right. Yeah, you kind of have to plan. You need to have a roadmap for your game, and you need to have a list of what everybody needs to do. And then you can be flexible about your list, but you need that list. So yeah, it takes more prep. And I think that makes it daunting, because a lot of Chronicles of Darkness lends itself really well to winging it. At least I find that it lends itself really well. So,
yeah, I think most of our games are a little bit more toolboxy than Promethean tends to be. A little bit easier just to kind of say, like, okay, well, now you go here, and then you do this, and then this happens, and whatever. And with Promethean, since there are such obvious goals in mind that you may not have in all of our other games, it's definitely, yeah, you do need a little bit more of a, like you said, more of a map or a story that you're going off of.
Yeah, and exactly. And 12 of the milestones that you need to hit in your pilgrimage are, you know, they're known. Like, everybody has to do Multiplicatio. And then, as a storyteller, you figure out what that looks like for this Promethean. But they do have to do it. And there's, like,
right.
And I think at the top of my head, there's 10 or 12 things that they need to do, these things. So as a storyteller, you need to be aware of when you want to introduce something that lets them do that, or when at the end of the session you're like, oh, you did that, let me mark that one off for you. But yeah, you need to be alert and plan it. And I think it's not as difficult as people think it is, but I do think there's an added difficulty level that seems more daunting than it is, but that definitely has people going, oh, I could never run Promethean. Yeah, everybody can run Promethean. You just need to sit down and spend a couple of hours or 1 hour working on what your game is going to look like.
Right. Probably preferably after knowing what the characters are and everything.
Yeah, you have to, because otherwise you can't make the milestones. I don't know what Multiplicatio, that means that's the milestone of creating another Promethean. And in past editions, that was the past edition. That was literal. You had to make another Promethean. And we've opened that up. It could be finding somebody who fell from the pilgrimage and helping them return, which is also making somebody who wasn't a Promethean because they weren't pilgrimaging and making them a Promethean again. So we opened the definition up, but you would have to see a character to know what definition they are probably going to go for. And you have to talk to your players, because making somebody else a Promethean is essentially cursing them. And true. Because it's such a humanist game, sometimes the player objects to that because they're there for the humanist experience and they don't want to curse a fictional character, which is fair. And we've offered ways around that in a second edition. But yeah, you need to know who your players are and what their characters are like before you can figure out what your pilgrimage is going to look like.
That definitely makes sense. I mean, are you running any games right now, whether Promethean or something else?
No, because my dedicated... Well, I am, in theory, running a Pathfinder group. It's going very slowly through WhatsApp. It's pre-made. I'm running Rise of the Rune Lords. It's a very famous Pathfinder game. I'm doing that specifically because running a pre-made adventure, I homebrew a lot in it, but that means I don't have to do as much prep work. My enemies have all been started and the main events have been cleared. And I'm running a Vampire the Masquerade V20 group, also in theory. Which is running, I'm actually running a Los Angeles-based chronicle on the setting that I wrote for Beckett's Jihad Diary, because I loved that setting. I loved the entire book, but I've always wanted to do a Los Angeles setting. And I wrote parts of the Anarchs and the Thin Bloods, so I did my Los Angeles game on that. But unfortunately, my players have all moved to new jobs, and they've had babies. And so it's hard to actually schedule a game where everyone can make it. So hence...
Yeah, once all your friends start becoming parents and moving and doing
exactly.
jobs and things, it becomes
it
a lot harder
It used to be you're all in
was.
School, and then you have the weekends off. And now people are working the weekends, and... plus I have... So it's hard, but I'm still running games. It's just not as... It used to be monthly, like I would run one or two games every month, and now it's more like, let's see, is there a weekend left in 2018 that we can meet? But that's also why I moved my Pathfinder game to WhatsApp, because at least now everyone can read along.
I still think the some of the Onyx Path writers and developers should have a chronicle that we run, and we put the videos on the Onyx Path YouTube channel or the like, so people can see how the experts do it. You know, how to truly butcher a game of Promethean, and it's a game. Five of us to run it and fail catastrophically.
Yeah, exactly.
I would love to do some kind of actual play with us that are actually, you know, more within the company. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Well, in that case, Dixie, I'm going to cut a promo on you now. I'm going to throw down the steel chair again. Yeah, but
this time, to me like two episodes ago.
I know this time I'm holding the championship belt aloft, and I'm saying that championship belt is yours. You have earned yourself a title shot if you can somehow, brother, organize... an actual play for a bunch of us to host on the Onyx Path YouTube channel. It can be whatever game you want. I'm not going to make you choose which game right now, because that would be unfair. Although I did do something similar last time. But that's the gambit. That's the gauntlet I've thrown down. But while you're mulling that over, I've got one last question for Steffi regarding Promethean before we move on to some other games. And it's something that's been playing on my mind a little. It's something I've been asked a lot of. Now... one of the key concepts of Promethean is disquiet. Disquiet being the kind of aura you project. This was more pronounced in first edition, but it's the aura you project that sort of despoils the world around you and turns the people against you. The kind of thing that makes the villagers come after you with burning torches, pitchforks, and the like. Because, after all, it's a game of Frankenstein's monsters.
Are actually the youngest lineage. Mm. So it's a game of... But that maybe that makes them most iconic. It's the most recent one we know. But okay, go ahead with your question.
Okay, in most of our games, in fact, I'd say almost all of our games, one of the key characters in a game is the city. It's the almost built into every storyteller game. The storyteller is expected to detail the city with key locations, key characters, key events. You know, you become familiar with your territory or the rack or the loads or whatever game you're playing. Promethean, however, has a theme of wandering, of pilgrimage, of moving around. How do you think that can be managed? What kind of advice would you give to a storyteller who is familiar with our games but isn't familiar with the idea of having to come up with new settings for each chapter in the Chronicle? Because I think that might be something that puts people off of playing Promethean.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so disquiet makes people come after you with pitchforks, but it also makes reality itself hate you. And it reacts with lightning storms and fires and all sorts of nasty things. And we have toned it down a little bit in second edition. If you stick with your throng, it's a little less than it usually is. But yeah, eventually you're going to have to move. It's a given of this game. It's also part of what makes being a Promethean really, really horrible. You can never settle down. And going home is exactly one thing everyone loves. But you can never go home as a Promethean. You have no home. Home hates you. And so does everyone who lives there. The thing that I would do, would recommend to a storyteller is to write locations and people as you usually would, but then spread them out. This one is in wherever they start. This one is in New York. And you put three of them there. And then you reserve the others for wherever they are going to go next. And I would probably connect them if your players allow that. If they deliberately go out of the way, like, we're leaving New York and we are never, ever coming anywhere near anyone related to the Mordeaux family, well, then that's it. But otherwise, you could definitely introduce the cousin of somebody they've met, or the daughter, or the son, and then, you know, have them invested not in one person, but maybe in a family.
Mm. So essentially create the connectivity across, let's say, the North American continent.
Yeah.
But
also disquiet is a personal thing. You can talk to people on the internet as a Promethean, and we actually have stories in the anthology of a Promethean who is on a message board with other Prometheans. They do that. That helps.
I remember.
So that is another way to establish connectivity. You can have them meet people online, and then when the time comes that they have to flee, they can go there and, you know, mess up that relationship, because the moment people meet them, they're like, oh yeah, I hate you. I don't know why, but I do. Or I'm obsessed with you and I want to worship you, or I want to be like you, or I want to cut off your skin and wear it for myself because you are so amazing. Lots of bad things happen when you're a Promethean and you meet people in person, unfortunately.
You just went through an awful lot of different Promethean types those various descriptions.
But yeah, you need to still create. I would create that connectivity by focusing on families and focusing on people that they maybe met online or through letters. But yeah, it's a game of moving.
Right, and that's interesting because like Matthew said, most of our games are not really intended for you to move all over the place. They're intended for you to kind of stay. Yeah. Either in one area, maybe you travel a little bit, do some things, come back to home base.
But you could, if you have a big city, like if you're in New York, you could probably move around from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Oh yeah, just like do the different boroughs and stuff, like as you...
Yeah, like you set fire to the last one, so it's time to move neighborhoods. Which, yeah, that could also work.
Yeah, wouldn't it create nice connectivity as well, because it means you're still within travel distance of your previous borough,
and the police are still looking for somebody matching your description.
Exactly.
So you could also pick a really big city. But the thing is also that Prometheans leave pilgrimage markets for each other. And if you go to a certain place, then your pilgrimage might be easier because they imprinted it with their knowledge that you can then use for yourself. And so... But I guess it's up to the storyteller. You could absolutely go like Hong Kong is so big, I could have multiple markers across the city. Or you could go tell them that, no, my game wants you to go to that mountaintop in Nepal where there's another pilgrimage marker waiting for you. So I guess that's up to the individual storyteller and the group and what their preferences are, but you could definitely do both.
That is one of those things I loved in both editions of Promethean, the idea of, I guess, a secret language between the Prometheans. It's something shared by Werewolf, the idea of, obviously in Werewolf you might graffiti tag your territory so the other packs know this part of the city is your own. And on the exact same wall, you have a Promethean tag that says, you know, this is the way to X. You know, if you want to meet this maker of clones, go down this alley, that kind of thing. Or don't go down here, there's Centimani nearby. And the supernatural creatures in Chronicles of Darkness all having their own little secret codes that maybe that in, if you were playing The Witcher, you know, the video game, you'd be going to the local village notice board and picking up on quests and investigating all these things. In Chronicles of Darkness, you just need to go into the wrong part of the city and all the graffiti painted over the walls, their coded messages from vampires, werewolves, Prometheans, all kinds of things. I think that's, it's fantastic. It's something I don't see a lot of storytellers doing, but it's a way of really making the world feel like it has another level to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and because Prometheans are so very, very rare, they actually rely on that stuff a lot. Because the odds of meeting a Promethean live, other than your throng and the Centimanus, who's gonna... but statistically speaking, the odds of meeting another Promethean are very small, so they do leave markers for each other everywhere. Because that is how you would meet another Promethean. Of course, in-game, you meet a lot of them. But that's the nature of games. I mean, Vampire has that too.
Games are usually a special situation.
Yeah, but Vampire has that too. I remember that per the old Vampire, the revised edition books, the Netherlands was, Amsterdam was very, very Camarilla heavy with Jan Peterson and stuff. And every game I played, there were so many anarchs that's, within we don't like authority, Dutch people in general, so we like all of the Netherlands is Camarilla territory, except for this one city and also the other city that we're playing in, and that one. So basically every city with a player troop was anarch territory, but then the country was Camarilla territory, which is simply how games skew.
So speaking of Vampire, what other Onyx Path, White Wolf games that you've worked on have been some of your favorites or favorite experiences? What other game lines are you like invested in?
So I'm emotionally a very, I was actually talking to a friend of mine about this very subject a while ago. I'm very emotionally invested in Vampire Masquerade because it helped me in a moment of my life where I needed that kind of help, like the exploration of darkness and how to cope with darkness that Vampire offers helped me out a lot. So that game is always, every time I work on it, it's like coming home. I loved working on Beckett's Jihad Diary for that reason. It's very close to my heart. But I also love the Chronicles of Darkness because as a storyteller, those fit my style better. They're more sandboxy and more open-ended. And more immediately about the players. So there's a duality there for me that the Requiem is something that I would enjoy running more. My players won't let me. They're all huge Masquerade fans. Whenever I propose Vampire, it has to be the Masquerade. But I think I would probably enjoy running the Requiem best because it fits my style. But the Masquerade is definitely, every time I play it, I'm like, oh yeah. I know this game, and I know these NPCs, and I know the setting. And it was very important to me in a time where I needed something to be important. So I will have that with me forever.
Oh, well, wonderful. Well, that's similar to my getting into Vampire. I've got a very strong connection to World of Darkness and Chronicles of Darkness both, but I see exactly what you mean regarding the issue of trying to convert diehard World of Darkness fans to playing Chronicles of Darkness. I have run into the exact same issues. What games, all right, so for the benefit of the listener, What games were you running at the UK Games Expo for Onyx Path? Because, and maybe you can tell us a little about the scenarios you were running for the groups there.
So I did Monarchies of Mao on the first day because I love cats. It's kind of funny because initially I was with Pugmire. I was like, oh, it's going to wet dogs. Then we got Monarchies of Mao and I was like, oh, cats, I love cats. So I read Monarchies of Mao, what Eddie sent me. And then I went back and also read Pugmire and I'm like, oh, Pugmire is amazing. I want to be on Pugmire, but you know, initially. So it's odd how that worked for me. The scenario that I ran for Mao was the pre-made adventure that will also be in the core book, where they go to a city that's being overrun by mice and rats, and the mayor of the city asks them to solve the problem, which was...
I love that adventure.
Yeah, you did. They loved it
so much.
Loved it. Yeah, they. It was funny because I don't know when you wrote it, but they translated it almost immediately to present circumstances, and they were like, "We are not kicking these people out. These people need a home. We're gonna help them to establish themselves, and you know, the mice and the rats. We're not kicking them out. We're not those kind of people. We're gonna help the downtrodden." Even if they're different from us, and even if typically they're looked down on. So that was funny. They were definitely going in it with, you know, an out-of-character investment. But it was a great scenario. People, they loved it. I had three players. They loved it. They went a little crazy at the end. They all knew each other. And so at the end, there was an in-character conflict that they solved by just going full player versus player, because you know that's easier to do if you're all friends. That's easily forgiven. Mm. So that was a lot of fun. And I resurrected. Well, not resurrected. One of them had found a crystal that they could cast a spell in, and I told them that you release the spell by breaking the crystal. That's not how the crystal worked, but I thought that was a cool effect. And he cast a healing spell in it. And at the end of the game, the other two players betrayed him and they stabbed him, well, his character. And I did with them, I did the epilogue of how the game ended, etc. And then I ended it with deep in the dark bowels of the city. A nearly dying cat falls onto that crystal and it breaks and it releases the healing spell. And now he claws his way back out of the dark and he swears vengeance on his former party members. And they were like, no!
I can see it.
So that was so much fun. And one of them actually said, and I thought that was the best line afterwards, he said, I felt so much more invested in my character now that it was a cat.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I think
we've had so...
I think there are a few people that feel that way with Pugmire and with Monarchies. Yeah, we've had... There are quite a few people who are like, I love it so much.
Fantastic
more.
Feedback for both of those games from all over the place, from players of all ages as well, because I know Matt was running Pugmire, wasn't he? And he had a child in his group, I think a young teenager, and a bunch of adults. And this was, I think, the teenager's first time role-playing as well. And so at the end, because all of us who were there, Steffi, Matt, myself, and Steffi's friend Mariana, we were equipped with books that we were going to be giving out to our players as well, as freebies, you know, thank you very much for playing, check out our products, that kind of thing. And it's sort of least you can do if someone comes along to play for your game. And at the end of the Pugmire game Matt was running, he asked the group to all vote for the best player, and of course all the adults voted for the kid, and he got the book and it made his day and he fell in love with Pugmire, and it's fantastic the kind of emotions we seem to be drawing out of people with this, what is ultimately a very simple concept for a game, is magnificent. And I love those stories where people connect such importance to Monarchies of Mao and Pugmire, because that's what role-playing is all about, I guess.
I gave my giveaway copy to the cat who was betrayed at the end, but they were all in agreement that he earned that for being stabbed in the back by his people.
This is the first time that I've heard of a game of either Pugmire or Monarchies ending with people turning on each other. Usually the parties
I think it helps a lot that these three
together.
People, they knew each other very well. They played with each other so much. That was clear.
Right.
So I think if they didn't know each other, they would have shown more restraint. But now they were like... And the funny thing is, one of them, I think he, based on the interaction, I think he played the social character in their other game. So kind of instinctively, he did the talking here. But he had really, really bad stats for socializing. And once he figured that out, he played that. So he would be like, hold on. Let me speak to the peasants. You there, riffraff boy, can you tell me when you've seen? And people were like, yeah, no. And then he would bribe them, which worked well. But that was hilarious that he did the talking, but he did it really badly because his stats were awful when it came to talking.
Right. I love it when characters actually, or when players actually get into the character stats they're providing. Because, yeah. I mean, I tend to play more face talking charisma type characters in games. So if I'm handed a pregen with low social, I have the same problem where I have to kind of look at it for a minute and go like, oh, wait, I'm not very nice.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm not very good with people in this version of myself.
Yes.
And that's part of the fun of role-playing, is getting to play somebody who isn't like yourself.
It is.
Because, you know, talkative and extroverted usually. So playing someone who's not that is always fun.
I'm going to do my staple of interrupting here just to...
Matthew Dawkins interrupting time.
Yeah, fancy that. I have to give kudos to Steffi here. Something that... You probably wouldn't know. Well, there's no reason anyone would know this. But so one of the games, as Steffi was pointing out, Steffi ran Scion as well.
Okay.
And due to the late registration of some of the games there, I don't think you had many players sign up.
I had zero sign-ups.
Yeah.
So I camped out in the room where people register for games. And every time somebody walked in, I was like, you look like a person who wants to play a demigod investigating a murder mystery. And I got a full set of people at my table and they loved it. So that was...
Yeah, I was one table over playing, actually getting to play, I know, a game of Chronicles of Darkness. But you could hear the laughter and the shouts, you know, the action from the game of Scion just over the other side of the room where Steffi was running. And, you know, it's one of those things I love about conventions, especially in the UK. I can't speak for how it is in America because I've not been to enough conventions over there. But when you see role players looking for a game, you just incorporate them. And Steffi did that for us marvelously with Scion and gave six people who may not have otherwise had a game a fantastic game of Scion, which was quite apparent from the noise that was coming over from that side of the room. So thank you very much for that, Stephanie.
You're welcome. I had a blast and did it.
You made a day for six people, and that's wonderful.
Yep,
that's good. Well, we're probably gonna wrap up soon. I wanted to ask you one more question though, and that was, I know you've done work for, like I said earlier, a lot of other companies. So outside of Onyx Path, White Wolf Games, what are your favorites that you've worked on or that you've played? Just, you know, most people have interests outside of the main company they work for.
I'm in Angry Hamster Publishing with Liz, and I love that setting. It's also a world like ours, but with supernaturals. But a lot of games have that. Dresden Files has that. So it's definitely a different game. And in which what happens is you sell your soul to a demon, an actual demon from hell. It's a very multicultural game. So there are various demons, but they're all demons. Or your parents sold your soul. And then at some point you realize that that was probably a really, really bad deal. So now you're a witch, you have powers, and you have a devil who wants to collect your soul at some point, and you need to figure out a way underneath, you know, you have to figure out how to get out from that deal. So that's a very interesting game because the source of your power is also the thing that you're trying to break away from. And you don't want to sacrifice your power while doing that. So you need to backstab this basically immortal entity who owns your soul. So good luck with that. And in that same universe, we're currently writing Afterlife, Wandering Souls, which is about you died and you went to the afterlife, but it's not the right one. So if you're a Christian, you ended up in Valhalla. If you're a Muslim, you ended up at the River Styx. If you're an atheist, well, you ended up in any of them, and you're like, huh, well, who would have guessed? And you have to quest through the afterlife to find yours. And that's a very interesting game. It's actually lighter and more fun, despite the fact that you're dead. And sometimes you meet people who know that they're in the afterlife, so they're welcoming. They're like, oh, yeah, you're one of those lost wandering souls. Come in, we'll give you a cup of tea and help you out, and then you can slay this monster for us, and then you can be on your way. And then there are some people who don't know, and you kind of have to, you can't tell them, like, hi, we're all dead, because they'll freak out. So it's a game about wandering through the afterlife and finding the one that you are supposed to be in, which...
So is the idea there that you all play characters, the whole group has the same initial religious inclination?
No, you found each other on the way.
Okay. All right, cool.
So yeah, and you don't necessarily, if you're a Christian, you could end up in any afterlife, but not the one with the pearly gates or the fiery pits of hell, depending on your nature. So you could end up in any afterlife that isn't yours. And then you have to go find the
that
right one.
That sounds really cool. I kind of like the idea of questing through the various afterlives, because that gives you so much myth to work
with.
Yeah,
exactly. You'll be like, God damn it, Greeks and the three-headed dog. Who came up with this? Why are we here?
Yes.
Did it have to be a giant three-headed dog?
There are definitely some terrifying afterlives.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And I mean, some places could be quite peaceful, and you might just not want to find your own. You might just want to be like, I'd rather stay here. This is way cooler than where I thought I was going to go.
I'm an atheist, so I keep picturing myself like, all of these are wrong. I'm just looking for, you know, the end of everything. Where do I find that one?
And does that even exist?
Yeah, it's an interesting proposition, though, isn't it? If you're an atheist in that position, do you think, do you genuinely quest for oblivion?
Yeah, could I go for the reincarnation package? Where's that one?
Yeah.
I'll switch. I want to switch. I don't want to be an atheist anymore. Could I be a Christian? Where's the pearly gate?
And I mean, could you still be an atheist once you find afterlife?
Yeah, that'll
with,
probably
you know,
be a big
gods
shock.
And spirits and things.
But then again, most atheists, no, a lot of atheists are pretty militant in their belief. But I figure it will be a shock for all of them to realize that their religion, you know, they were all right.
Yeah, exactly.
I would take the stance of one of the factions in Planescape that doesn't believe in gods, despite the fact in Planescape you are right in the center of the planes where all the gods exist. Yeah. They insist on calling them powers, and even when they go to their planes, their heavens and their hells and all of that, they just say, well, if they were truly gods, we wouldn't be able to visit them. You know, we wouldn't be able to go to these places. Yeah. This can't really be heaven or hell, because if it was, I wouldn't be conscious of it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, maybe the atheist is going around just, this is all like a mass, we're all just a mass delusion, we're on the threshold of death, and we're all making this up. You're not real, the lot of you. You're figments of my imagination. I can imagine the other characters growing tired of you really quickly.
May I ask one Chronicles of Darkness question before we wrap up the interview? Because I know that you worked on Changeling the Lost, second edition. And that's a book that's still on Backerkit. You can still back for premium version, and that was funded on Kickstarter a few months ago to great success. And the reason this came up recently is because I've been developing a book outside of Onyx Path for a game called Cult Divinity Lost. And one of the books that's referenced in that for, you know, like we often do in our books, you look to other books for inspiration, is Changing the Lost Second Edition, and specifically the parts that you wrote with Jacqueline Brick. So there you go. You get cited as a reference in another RPG. One thing I wanted to ask you, because Changeling is a game that we've spoken a lot about emotions in role-playing games, especially in Promethean, but Changeling is probably the pinnacle of emotional overwroughtness in Chronicles of Darkness. If you were to pitch Changeling the Lost to anyone who's not heard of it before, how would you do that? What would be your key beats regarding Changeling?
Oh, that's difficult. I love Changeling, by the way. It's probably that and the Requiem and Promethean are my on Demon. Okay, I love all of them. Never mind. I would pitch it as trying to figure out how many parts of yourself you can lose and still remain you, and which parts you have to hang on to, and which parts you have to get back. I think that is the essence of Changeling the Lost. Finding out how much you can change and still be you.
And that's a question a lot of people, you know, can't answer. Much like the whole Promethean, you know, everybody wants to be human.
Yeah,
thing.
Exactly.
You always wonder, like, I mean, I don't know if everybody else does, but I have anxiety, so I wonder about weird things.
Yeah.
Like, gotcha. You know, you definitely wonder, like, hey, would I still be me if this thing hadn't happened, or would I still be the same person if, you know...
And also, would it matter?
This one thing was different? Yeah, exactly.
Like...
Would I be happier? Would I be sadder? Mm. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think that's the lost. How much of yourself can you lose, and should you fight to hold on to, or fight to get back? And still be.
Yeah, we've had some debate about whether or not Changeling is a hopeful or traumatic game.
I think it's both.
over
I think
time.
It's both. Yeah. I think it starts with trauma. I mean, it's a traumatic thing that happens at the beginning of the game or in the prelude. But yeah, I think the fact that you survived and you got through that, I think it's hopeful. I think anything that you can survive is hopeful in a way.
Yeah, that was my thought on it. And then Matthew had a story about everybody crying during the game. So
yeah, well, it's an emotional game, and the thing is, I can see how people who struggle with things would see that come back in Changeling the Lost, and be reminded of things. But I think a lot of Chronicles of Darkness games, some more than others, require you to sit down with your player and figure out what they can and cannot see or want to see in a game.
That makes sense. Well, is there anything that you would like to say before we wrap this up? Anything you'd like to promote? Social media, etc.? Websites?
Well, if people haven't backed Changeling the Lost yet, they should. And they should also check out angryhamsterpolishing.com, because we have quick starts for our games and beta versions that you can play. And I'm pretty sure that if you like my work on for Onyx Path, assuming people know what I wrote, they would like those games too.
Yeah, if you go on drivethrurpg.com and just search Steffi Devan, which you'll see that spelled out in the title,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Double A.
You can find everything that she's worked on that's on Drive-Thru at least. Although there are more projects outside of that, but that's a good place to kind of find what else she's done. I think a lot of people will be surprised if they don't read the credits pages too often at how many of our projects you've had your fingers on. So Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Steffi. I do hope I get to meet you in person one day.
Yeah, same here. We should,
Rich,
we should definitely smuggle one of us across the... probably, you should probably come to Europe. I don't know if I would make it past checkpoints.
Well, we'll leave, that's a mysterious note to end on.
No, I mean, there's been rumors about... You know, the border security checking people's social media pages about opinions they have.
Yeah,
exactly. And I'm not sure if my opinions would be welcome.
Oh, they might not let me back in if I leave.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll always have a place on my sofa, Dixie.
You can stay on my couch.
Excellent.
There you go. You've got two. You've got a choice of couches. No, we've all got spare rooms.
Actually,
but you're not
I have a spare bed there.
That's an upgrade.
I'll see Matthew's couch.
All right,
couch,
I'm going
bed.
To the Netherlands.
I live very near
I'm gonna go
a hotel.
Live with
which he will make you pay for yourself.
I've got an emergency question for you, Steffi, before we cut off. Emergency questions are questions we use usually when there's a break in questioning. But we've got to the end. And this is, as all emergency questions, they are all from the mind of comedian Richard Herring. But this one is one that I would be particularly interested in hearing your answer to. What is the most interesting thing you have found in the embers of a fire?
Thoughts.
Well, that's deeper than what Eddie came up with earlier, I think, when we were testing.
Did
that
he say
question.
A gun?
No, a gun. Well, that would be interesting. Thoughts. Because, yeah, in all kinds of detective shows, there's always someone raking through the embers of a bonfire. They always find something, like a bone or a gun, or in Eddie's case, it was self-respect, I think.
Oh,
right. The thoughts. Yeah, I think when you're clearing out a fireplace, that is a good time to think. Anyway, on that.
But we would all love to find self-respect. No, I've got self-respect. So.
Yeah. I do hope to see you, Steffi. If you get the chance to come over to Dragon Meet in December in London, that's the UK's probably second biggest gaming convention. You would be more than welcome, and. Hopefully we'll get to see each other then. If not, some other time.
Yes, certainly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that was fun. I'm back now with Eddie and Matthew.
Hello. Yeah, that was really good. I particularly like the kind of stealth deep dive into Promethean that happened. That was actually genuinely interesting.
Yeah, we almost went as hard on that one as we did on Requiem and didn't even really mean to. We just got super into design philosophy and how the game works and what we love about it. So
wonder
that was
whether
great.
We will do a Promethean episode at some point in that case. Is there a need?
We just did a Promethean episode.
Yeah,
it's done.
There's still a need. There'll be some people who are saying, where's my Promethean episode? Maybe half a dozen of them, and no, that's doing the game an injustice. And it's a shame. It's a fantastic game. It needs more players, needs more readers. And I hope that this interview has compelled some of you to pick it up for the second edition, because it is an excellent game, brilliantly written.
Yeah, I will say that by the time we're recording this, the Requiem episode that we did has gone out, and I've been hearing lots of people saying not only, you know, thanks for the deep dive, but also I never thought of Requiem that way. I'm more interested in looking at it again now. So definitely it does seem like some people are really inspired by these kind of breakdowns.
I get it.
In fact,
go ahead. Sorry.
I was just saying, a few people actually asked for one on Monarchies of Mao, so maybe we should do that sometime in the near future.
Mm. Yeah, we should definitely do that soon. I got an almost irate message from one of our fans
that
was like, what are you doing? Now I have to play Requiem. Damn it. it was fine. It was listen to episode 7 of the Pathcast. Fine. Vampire the Requiem 2nd sounds awesome. And then he's like, you know, talking to himself out loud in the car, apparently.
Next one, then, we'll find a game we really hate, just so we can put people off playing for it, just to please that one fan. They came, yeah, very nice, very nice. Yeah, there are words
Love
I will
you.
Not repeat on this civil podcast, but once the recording has ended, Mr. Webb, then you are mine.
Curse you,
what timely news do we have?
So the Fetch Quest Kickstarter is about to wrap up. In fact, by the time this launches, it will have just ended. And looking at it right now, it looks like we're about 300% funded. It's only $20,000. It's not like our most exciting Kickstarter, but you know, it's well funded. That's good. That's gonna be good.
Do you want to give like a quick Fetch Quest blurb? I'm not sure we've actually talked about it too much.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Fetch Quest is actually it's a Pogmire related game, but it's a card game. It's a family friendly cooperative deck building game, which is something that Onyx Path has never done before. They've done a card game, for instance, Gambit, but that was much more a competitive social game. This is something that's closer to like a Dresden Files card game or the like. So it was something that I put together, seemed to do really well in playtesting. And Richard's like, yeah, let's give it a try. So we put the Kickstarter together. And again, we weren't expecting it to be massive. It's not an area we normally work in. But it is Pugmire. Pugmire has generally been a strong brand for us the past few years. So, you know, we got a lot of people who want to check this out. So it's a nice little game that we can play between game sessions, you know, if you can't get your group together or whatever. So, and it can get people more excited about Pugmire as a concept, because it has the great art that Pugmire has, and a lot of the flavor comes through in the cards. So,
very cool. I look forward to getting to play with it at Gen Con for the first time. I have not gotten to play it.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to be looking at the cards soon, from what I understand, to proof them. But
yes, you have to edit them for me.
But yes, I haven't actually gotten to play it, so that'll be fun.
Yeah.
We also had this past Wednesday, we had Kith Book Boggin come out for Changeling 20th anniversary.
For Changeling, yes, for Changeling the Dreaming, the Kith that was forgotten.
Poor Boggins.
Poor old Boggins. Never got a Kith book back in the dizzy days of second edition Changeling the Dreaming, but now they finally got a book to support them, and it has been wonderfully written, wonderfully developed. Pete Woodworth is the man behind that, man with the plan, and he has shepherded this one to fruition, and I'm very glad to see it, because I love Changeling the Dreaming. I was lucky enough to work on the 20th anniversary, and this book is such a fine compliment to that. So to any Changeling collectors out there, this book completes the collection, I guess. So please do check it out. Also, this is, I guess, one of the most important things for me. When it comes to Changeling the Dreaming, one of the things that always drew me into the game was the art style, and we've been able to maintain that. This book, despite being, gosh, I suppose, over 15 years removed from the previous Kith book, maintains consistency and quality from the original, so it's not going to look out of place on your shelf, and I personally consider that a very important feature.
Yeah, all the art's really, really nice for it, and definitely, you know, reminiscent of the other ones. So yeah, so if you like the other Kith books, if you're a Changeling 20 fan, if you're a Boggin fan, definitely look into that. As you can find links to that and everything else we've been releasing at theonyxpath.com. Also, where can they find you, Eddie, on social media?
I feel like, I mean, I miss it's deja vu. I feel like...
Yeah, they already know. They know. He's Eddie Fate. He's Eddie Fate everywhere.
It's true. Literally everywhere. Like, the guy walking down the street, if he's holding a sign saying Eddie Fate, that's me.
That is probably true. If there's a guy holding a sign that says Eddie Fate, he's either picking you up from an airport...
which has never happened.
Or it's you.
Right. But yes, if you put Eddie Fate, EddyFate, into any social media site, that's me. And also you can find me at my website, which is eddyfate.com.
And Matthew?
Well, on YouTube, you can find me as The Gentleman Gamer. On the Onyx Path forums, you can find me as The Gentleman Gamer. And on Twitter, you can find me as Clack Click Bang. I'm also lurking around Facebook as Matthew Dawkins.
You can find me on Twitter and other social media as Dixie Cyanide. Dixie like my first name, Cyanide like the poison. You can find everything about The Onyx Path at theonyxpath.com. You can also, if you like what we're doing here, you can rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean. We would love to have some more reviews, just because that's what kind of gets us up there. Let us know what you like, let us know what you don't like. Don't be too mean. I'm very sensitive. No, I'm not.
It's
I'm
true.
On the
they
internet.
Can even just be one-liners, you know? Not to sound too desperate for reviews. but as Dixie says, that is what gets podcasts really noticed on things like iTunes. It's the reviews, the ratings, and the like. So even if your review is just, I love this podcast. Don't all write that now, please. Although you can, I guess. But I think if 20 reviews suddenly go up and say, I love this podcast, we might be investigated. The variations on it. I adore this podcast. J'adore le podcast de Onyx Path. That kind of thing. Yeah.
Just hear our French listenership going down as you're talking.
Yeah, this is not good. We already got a little political this episode. Now we're getting a little racist. Let's just calm down. All right. Well, as always, thank you for listening. Remember, many worlds, one podcast.